Thank you. So my name is Will Noyd. I'm an assistant professor at Penn State. I've been there for 5 years now. So I'm very grateful for the opportunity to tell you about what we've been doing there, and to the organizers for inviting me here and for organizing such a stimulating conference. I'd also like to acknowledge my group, which now has 5 students. Joe Rudzinski, who is an undergraduate here working with Paul Atzberger, has done a lot of the more recent work, but I should also acknowledge Wayne Mullinax, who was a key driving force earlier in the beginning of this work. And I'm also like to acknowledge Scott Schell, who I've had very stimulating conversations with here in the last few weeks. And also, I'm very grateful that in the last year or two, I've been able to attract some funding for some of this. So that's a very great thing. I'll start my talk about coarse graining with this paper, which is generally considered to be the first paper on coarse grain models of proteins. And as you can see, it's from 1975, and the motivation for having coarse grain models of proteins to study folding was even more compelling in 1975 than it is today. But more than that, this paper very elegantly, I think, states the driving motivation for coarse grain modeling. Not only does it give you a powerful tool for studying things much more efficiently, for studying long time scales that you couldn't access with more detailed models, but it also simplifies problems and it gives you the opportunity to try to focus on the details that you really care about. So there's not only computational advantages, there are also conceptual advantages. So that paper launched a whole industry. All the leaders in the field at that time started doing coarse grain models of protein. But that kind of came to some sort of crashing halt just a few years later in this PNAS paper published in 1978 by Barry Honig, where he pointed out that it's all well and good to make a cheap computational model and represent a protein with something with a whole bunch of beads, but if it's not properly parameterized, who knows what are the results you'll get. You might as well be just generating totally artificial results, generating structures that have fundamental flaws if you don't carefully vet your model, and you might get the right results for the wrong reason. So this kind of signaled some kind of train wreck in the field, and it kind of stopped this field, I think, for about 10 years. And then around 1990, the idea of coarse graining protein models again came into vogue, and now we're very much in that phase again. And that kind of motivates a lot of what we're doing, is trying to think about how we can make these cheap models but capture the right physics, especially when we don't know what that physics is. Can we use an underlying model to inform it, to inform how to put the right physics in? And a very appealing approach for this problem was suggested in a very nice paper by Harald Chiraga back in 1976. At the time, the protein data bank was just first being developed, and at the time, I think there were about 50 structures. Now there's something like 80,000 structures of proteins in the protein data bank. And they asked the question, how can I take these structures in the protein data bank and figure out what are the correct effective interactions for coarse grain models of proteins? It's a very appealing idea, and it's kind of generated, I would say, a cottage industry, except for it's much more than a cottage. Of what are known as knowledge-based approaches, where people devise various frameworks, various computational algorithms for trying to take these structures in the protein data bank and use them to determine coarse grain models of proteins. And largely those can be categorized into two different approaches, one of which you might call the foldability criterion, in which you take a whole bunch of different proteins, different sequences, you take their structure in the protein data bank, and you try to optimize the potential so that in each case, the folded PDB structure corresponds to the minimum of the potential energy function for that protein. Another approach, which I think is more popular and which is closer to what Chiraga originally suggested, although Chiraga obviously did a lot of work here too, is to rely upon something that you might call a Boltzmann hypothesis. And basically, this boils down to going through a set of structures in the protein data bank. And let's suppose you want to represent every amino acid as a single sphere. So you might represent this amino acid as a red sphere and that amino acid as a white sphere. And you count up how often do I find the red sphere at a given distance from a white sphere. You build up a histogram. Then you normalize that histogram and you call it a probability distribution. And then you take the ratio of this probability distribution measured from the protein data bank, divide it by some kind of quote-unquote reference probability distribution. This is devised based upon the idea that there would be no specific interactions between amino acids. You take the logarithm of this, multiply it by KT, and you determine a potential energy function, supposedly describing the interaction between this pair of amino acids. People argue a lot about what is the correct reference state, but that's something I don't want to get into. So there's at least two obvious concerns about this, aside from the fact whether or not structures in the protein data bank are good structures. And one is that the very notion of this idea is to look at the probability of finding these two amino acids at a given distance R and relating that directly to the interaction between the pair. But that's obviously not just due to the interaction between the pair, right? The probability of finding this pair of amino acids at a given distance R reflects the entire protein structure. It reflects the amino acids of neighboring, or the presence of neighboring amino acids. So it's obviously the pair distribution function doesn't just reflect the direct interaction. So that's one major concern with this type of approach. Another concern is that when you're doing this type of approach, you're combining structural statistics from multiple different proteins and using something like a statistical mechanical relationship between structure and potential. And these proteins are obviously not corresponding to any meaningful statistical mechanical ensemble. So how can you devise meaningful relationships between structures for different proteins and an underlying potential? Those were the two questions that motivated our original work. Simplifying everything just down to a very simple, basic two questions. If somebody gives me a collection of structures sampled from equilibrium for that protein, can I determine the potential energy function that generated those structures? That's the first question that we sought to answer. And the second is, really at the heart of lots of these problems having to do with coarse grain modeling, we've heard several times about transferability. How can I devise a coarse grain potential that works for multiple different proteins? So in other words, now I want to not just figure out a potential that works for this protein, but also for this and that protein. And those are the first two questions that our group sought to answer. And I should emphasize too, when I say I want to go from structures to potentials, we've heard a whole, there are a variety of different algorithms that we've heard a lot about already. Iterative Boltzmann is a method that we've heard about. We've heard Professor Lyubartsev talk about inverse Monte Carlo. We've heard Scott Shell talk about relative entropy. And these are all very beautiful and elegant methods, but they're all iterative. And I want to go directly from structures to potentials without guessing a potential, checking it, and refining it. I want to go directly from structures to potentials. And previously, there had been no way to do that. And those were the first two contributions from our group, is to show that those two questions can be answered to the affirmative, at least in principle. And that brings me to the outline of what I'm going to tell you about. So I'll start off by, first of all, giving a little of the basic theory of force matching that I worked on as a postdoc in Greg Vo's group and in very close collaboration with Hans Andersen, who was a great pleasure to work with. And then I'll tell you about our work and how we can do force matching without forces by using a generalization of a very old theory from liquid state theory, but now in a new context, to go directly from structures to potentials. I'll talk briefly about what we call an extended ensemble framework, which gives us a rigorous theoretic algorithm in which we can combine information from multiple different systems in order to try to improve the transferability of coarse grain potentials within a variational rigorous framework. I really hope to have a little time at the end to talk about some work that I'm very excited about that has been inspired by Scott Shell's very elegant work and more recently in collaboration with him since I got here. And I almost surely will not have time to talk about how mean forces give a connection between structure and force motivated coarse graining. But if I do, I'd like to talk about that as well. Okay, so to begin with, we need to have some language for talking about coarse graining. Oftentimes, this is kind of implicit, as in Professor Doy's talk. I'd like to make this explicit because it kind of helps me to understand what I'm doing and to have a language for writing things down very precisely. And so the first element in this language is to define a mapping operator that I call M, which is a transformation from an atomistic structure, which is defined by a set of Cartesian coordinates, into a set of Cartesian coordinates for a corresponding set of coarse grain sites. Most commonly, you might take the atomic coordinates for this amino acid and represent them with the Cartesian coordinates of the center of mass or center of geometry. So we're going to assume this transformation is linear. And I should note that I'm going to use lowercase symbols for atomistic things and coarse grain symbols, or big symbols, for coarse grain things. So now that I have a coarse grain representation, obviously the challenge is to determine what is the appropriate potential energy function for this model. And Professor Doy gave us the answer for that just a few hours ago. If we want our coarse grain model to reproduce the correct probability distribution of structures, the answer was actually given to us, I would say, by Kirkwood back in 1935. And Harold Chiraga, I think, may have introduced the idea of calling this a restricted free energy function, but perhaps someone did it before him as well. The basic idea is that you have a configuration space of a whole bunch of different atomistic configurations, all the possible structures your atomistic model for the system can adopt. And we assume that those are going to be sampled in the atomistic model according to a Boltzmann distribution with a given atomistic potential and a temperature T. Now, we want to construct a coarse grain model, and we want to sample its canonical ensemble according to some coarse grain potential U at the same temperature. Now, this mapping induces a transformation from atomistic structures into the coarse grain configuration space. In fact, it takes a whole volume element of atomistic configurations into a single point in the coarse grain configuration space. And I want to construct my coarse grain potential in such a way that the probability of the coarse grain model sampling this configuration is the same as the probability for the atomistic model to sample a particular configuration in this volume element that maps to this given coarse grain configuration. That defines a consistency criterion, and that means that the Boltzmann factor for my coarse grain model should just be proportional to the probability for all the atomistic configurations that map to the given coarse grain configuration. This is what's often referred to as a many-body potential of mean force as well. Okay? So this is called a many-body potential of mean force for a very well-defined meaning. This coarse grain potential that is in some sense ideal in the sense that it will perfectly reproduce the distribution of coarse grain configurations sampled by the atomistic model. If you take the forces derived from it, you end up with a force on coarse grain site I and coarse grain configuration R that's equal to the average force on the same site in the atomistic model, averaged over all the atomistic configurations that map to the given coarse grain configuration R. In other words, for a given coarse grain configuration, there's a whole range of different atomistic configurations that get mapped to that different coarse grain configuration. In each of these different atomistic configurations, the force on the site is a random variable. It could go in different directions. And the force generated by the potential of mean force corresponds to the conditioned canonical ensemble average of the atomistic force field. And this can rigorously be thought of as a projection operation, because averages can be considered projections of random variables. And that's important, and it gives the basis of of what we consider to be a variational principle for the multi-scale coarse graining method developed by Professor Vogt. And that is to define a functional chi-squared evaluated for a trial force field F prime by evaluating on site I this trial force field in the mapped representation of an atomistic configuration and comparing that force from the trial coarse grain model with the force on the same site in the given atomistic configuration according to the atomistic model. You square the difference, you average over sites, you average over configurations. And it just takes a few lines of algebra to show that the mean force field, the force field that's derived by the many-body potential mean force, and I should emphasize that this mean force field is sufficient to generate the correct distribution of coarse grain configurations, provides the variational minima of the global unique minima of this chi-squared function. Chi-squared for a given trial force field can be expressed as the chi-squared for the mean force field plus a positive definite term describing the difference between the trial force field and the mean force field. So that gives us a nice variational framework for determining this many-body mean force field or optimal approximations to it. But it also has a nice geometric interpretation that I found very instructive. And that is, if you think about what a force field is a collection of vector-valued objects that specify a Cartesian force on every site in any configuration. And when you think about it, the space of force fields, you can think of that as a vector in a high-dimensional abstract vector space. So there's a space of atomistic force fields, including the original atomistic force field. And then within that space of force fields lies a subspace of coarse grain force fields, or force fields that only depend upon the coarse grain representation of the configuration. Within this subspace lies the mean force field. In fact, it corresponds to the geometrical projection of the atomistic force field into the subspace of coarse grain force fields. And you can define an inner product and a norm in this space. And in fact, this functional is basically, this expression here is nothing more than the statement of the Pythagorean theorem within the space of coarse grain force fields. It can be thought of as the distance between the atomistic force field and the trial force field squared is equal to the distance between the mean force field and the atomistic force field squared plus the distance between the two coarse grain force fields. And so if you minimize this distance, while being constrained to lie within the subspace of coarse grain force fields, you simultaneously minimize that distance. And that gives a very nice geometric interpretation. Now that we've framed this as a vector space problem, we need to introduce a basis set. And the way that this is done is by thinking about what type of approximate coarse grain potential we want to use in our simulations. Typically, we want it to have a molecular mechanics type form. So it has non-bonded pair interactions, it has bond interactions, angles, dihedral angles, and whatever else you want to include. And if you want to go through and derive the corresponding force field, what you end up with is you apply the chain rule to each of these terms, and when you do that, you get a corresponding force function times something that is the derivative of this order parameter with respect to Cartesian coordinates. This corresponds to an element in this space of coarse grain force fields, and the coefficient corresponds to the magnitude of the force. So this gives us a basis set expansion for our coarse grain force field, where each different term in this potential defines a basis vector, and the magnitude of the corresponding force, the force function, corresponds to the coefficient. Now that we have this linear expansion of our coarse grain force field in a given basis set, we can substitute this into our chi-squared function, and this becomes a linearly squares problem for the force field parameters, the force functions that we want to solve for. Now, though, we're projecting the mean force field that we want to solve, that we ideally would like to achieve, but we can't get to. We're projecting this into the subspace spanned by our given basis set. One way to try to determine the projection of a high-dimensional vector, in this case the mean force field, into a low-dimensional subspace, is to take the projection of the high-dimensional vector, the mean force field, with each different basis vector, with each corresponding to a different interaction, we call that B, so that corresponds to this quantity here. And then we require that our approximation in this low-dimensional subspace should have the same projection onto that basis vector. We expand the coarse grain force field in this basis set, and now we have to take care of the inner product between this basis vector and that basis vector. And we call that corresponds to this quantity G. It's a kernel. And in fact, when you define the inner product in this space, what it basically corresponds to is the correlation between the force on each site from the two different interactions in a given configuration. And this is simply a structural correlation function that we want to evaluate. Now, normally when you evaluate, when you formulate a basis set for a given problem, you want to construct an orthogonal basis set. But in this case, the inner product corresponds to the correlation function, the correlation between the forces generated between these different interactions. That means that we're dealing with a skew symmetric basis set. In other words, if you think about the projection of the mean force field onto this basis vector, it has contributions not only from this interaction corresponding to this basis vector, but also, of course, contributions from correlated basis vectors. Okay? And so this is a key insight to this method, is that this metric tensor allows you to decompose projections of the mean force field onto a given basis vector into correlated contributions from all the terms in your coarse grain force field. And if you think about G1 as being perhaps corresponding to a pair potential, then the projection of the mean force field onto a basis vector corresponding to a pair interaction sounds kind of like a pair mean force. The pair mean force is closely related to the pair probability distribution. And so you can think of this as being closely related to the pair probability distribution, the probability of two amino acids being at a given distance, in this case Z. And now we're decomposing that probability distribution schematically into contributions from the direct interaction and from interactions with all the other particles in your system. Okay, now so far, this has all been expressed in terms of forces. And I said I wanted to do this in terms of structures. And so this is a slide where I do that. So on the previous slide, I want to project the mean force field on a given basis vector, construct my coarse grain force field to have the same projection. I expand this and I get this correlation function times the force function I need to solve for. And that's equal to this projection. So I need a new expression for this. I said that the projection of the mean force field defines B, and the mean force field is the average of the atomistic force field. So what you're actually doing in force matching is you're using the fluctuating atomistic force field as a surrogate for the mean force field to evaluate these structural correlation functions. In other words, you're directly projecting the atomistic force field onto your basis vectors. But I also said that this mean force field corresponds to the gradient of the potential of mean force. The potential of mean force is defined by the logarithm of the probability distribution. So I have the inner product of a basis vector with a gradient of this. And one thing that you do again and again in Macquarie, it seems, is that when you have expressions of this form, you do integration by parts because this inner product corresponds to a correlation function. When you do that, you end up with this being the derivative of a simple structural correlation function that corresponds to how often you find a pair of particles at a given distance z. And so now this is a simple structural correlation function you can calculate directly from structures. And that gives us a closed equation for the forces that we want to solve for in terms of a correlation between different interactions and a correlation function describing a single interaction. This corresponds to a generalization of a very ancient equation from liquid state theory known as the Yvonne-Born-Green equation. But this equation had never been generalized for more complicated potentials, and it had never previously been appreciated that it's not just exact in the direct sense, but it allows you a direct way for solving the inverse problem, for going from structural correlation functions to a set of potentials that provide an optimal approximation to the many-body mean force field. So that's kind of a key, that was one of the first key results in our group. Okay, I'm running out of time, so I'll just say that it works. We can take structures for something like a polymer, and we can go directly from those structures and quantitatively recover the underlying forces. Now, the second question I said I wanted to explain to you is our approach to trying to understand this problem of transferability. And I only have a few minutes, so I'll just sketch the outline of how this approach works. And I think that part of the key, and I think this is what one of the things that Professor Gumsch was emphasizing earlier, is that it's imperative that one is able to precisely define what one wants by transferability. And to me, that means that we need to be more precise in what we refer to as a model. And so I say, you know, one way to address this problem is to decompose a model into two different components. One is just to define what we call what a force field person would call the topology, the set of particles and bonds that I use to describe the system. And there's an atomistic topology and a coarse grain topology. One could also include the thermodynamic state point in here. That would be a sensible thing to do. Only after you've defined the topology can you think about defining the potential that describes the interactions between the different particles that you've defined for your model. And we want a potential to be transferable in the sense that it works for multiple different topologies. Now we need to define something else. We have to define what I refer to as an extended ensemble. And an extended ensemble is nothing more than a collection of equilibrium ensembles for different systems. You realize then that you have two different types of random variables. You know, this is just pasting together different configuration spaces for different systems. You have a configuration random variable that's dynamic, and you have a random variable that identifies which different system in this extended ensemble you're going to identify. And that's going to be treated as a quenched random variable. So you can define probability distributions for the quenched random variable, the system, and the dynamic random variable, the configuration, and then you can evaluate averages over this extended ensemble in a standard way that's done for dealing with systems that have quenched disorder. You first of all average over configurations for a fixed system, and then you average over systems. Okay, now we have to specify, the next thing is to define a mapping. And now you realize that there's two different components to your mapping. The first of these is to define a system mapping that specifies what different sites am I going to use in my coarse grain model. This is something that people need to think a whole lot more about. Only after you've specified this type of topology mapping can you specify a configuration mapping defining how the different coordinates of your coarse grain topology are defined. Then you need to determine the coarse grain potential for each different topology. This should start looking to be the same as where we started. We want to have a consistency criterion for determining this coarse grain potential or optimal approximations to it. And so we have to think about what is the configuration space for our extended ensemble. And that we proceed by pasting together the configuration space. So for each different protein, and this is protein 1, let's say, you have a configuration space of atomistic structures. For protein 2, you have a configuration space of atomistic structures, and so on and so forth. We're just pasting together configuration spaces for different proteins. We define a mapping. So we have a similar extended ensemble configuration space with the coarse grain model. We have different coarse grain proteins, and we have different coarse grain configuration spaces. This mapping transforms points in the atomistic configuration space to points in the coarse grain configuration space. If we want the coarse grain model to generate the same distribution of structures as the atomistic model, we come to the conclusion that we want a generalized potential of mean force, which makes us very happy because we already know how to determine this potential of mean force by generalizing the MSCG functional. Now the key approximation, and all the math that I showed you and went through in some detail earlier for approximating the mean force field using this chi-squared function follows through immediately when we define averages over this extended ensemble. So this gives us a framework for determining the force field that would actually reproduce the correct distribution of structures for each different coarse grain protein. or variational approximations to it. And the key approximation is that for each different protein, there's a potential of mean force, and we want to approximate it using a set of potential energy functions that are protein independent or transferable. This is the key to this whole framework. This is where the approximation comes in. One interesting result we found is that the transferability and accuracy of coarse grain models doesn't necessarily improve as you increase the resolution of your coarse grain model. That's kind of not immediately intuitive. I don't have time to show you that result. But one thing that I can tell you is that this does systematically improve the transferability of coarse grain potentials. And the result that I will take 30 seconds to explain is that we generalize this previous result for the case that we made a toy model of a protein data bank where we took different toy protein sequences, we folded them, we generated structures, and we calculated distribution functions, and again, we were able to quantitatively recover all the terms in the coarse grain potential. Now, the last thing that I want to tell you in these last 5 minutes, and I apologize that the last 5 or 10 minutes I've gone very quickly, but in the last 5 minutes that I've been promised, I'd like to tell you very briefly about some very recent work that I've been doing with Joe Radzinski, inspired by Scott Shell's very elegant work with the relative entropy functional. And that is to go back to this very classic paper by Kullback and Liebler and define an information function phi that expresses quantitatively the information content in a coarse grain configuration R for distinguishing between atomistic and coarse grain probability distributions. You define it simply by taking the logarithm of the probability that the atomistic model samples a coarse grain configuration and dividing that by the probability that the coarse grain model with a coarse grain potential U samples that same configuration. Obviously, there's no information for discriminating between the two ensembles if these two probability distributions are equal. On the other hand, if the ratio is very large, then there's a lot of information there for discriminating between the two different models. The relative entropy is defined as the average of this information function. And if you vary the relative entropy with respect to a potential in your coarse grain model, you can show that the relative entropy varies with this potential according to the difference between the probability distribution for that degree of freedom in the atomistic model and the coarse grain model. So the relative entropy is stationary with respect to variations in a given coarse grain potential when the coarse grain model reproduces the distribution for that degree of freedom. And Miko, who was here earlier, did some very nice work showing that relative entropy, when minimized by Newton's method, leads to the inverse Monte Carlo method. So that's very nice. So you can think of this as Scott's work provides a very elegant variational framework in which you can construct a whole bunch of different structure-based coarse graining methods. What's obvious in hindsight, but wasn't obvious immediately, is that actually force matching is very closely related to this information function. Whereas the relative entropy corresponds to the average of this information function, force matching corresponds to the average of the gradient squared of this information function. So that's rather amusing. They're both related to this information function in different ways. And in this work, we came up with a couple other results that are rather amusing. So we showed that force matching and structure-based coarse graining are identical for quadratic potentials. We were able to establish how similar these two approaches are. They're both variational problems in linear spaces using basis sets that are identical except for differentiation. We're able to immediately generalize this Henderson's uniqueness theorem that Marcus referred to earlier. But we're able to identify conditions for which the potentials generated by structure-based coarse graining should be unique. And it corresponds to the linear independence of your basis set, which isn't surprising, right? In retrospect, that's obvious. And what's amusing is, and again, this isn't surprising in retrospect either, is that you can show the relationship of the uniqueness for structure-based coarse graining to the uniqueness of force matching. The uniqueness of force matching actually implies the uniqueness of structure-based coarse graining. And we're able to generalize force matching in this structure, this Yvonne Born-Green theory, for arbitrary potentials. And one other thing that's really, and this is the last result I'll leave you with, because I think I'm out of time. 1 minute left, okay, thank you. Is if you think about, this is something that I'm currently working on with Scott that I find tremendously interesting. And that is if you think about the excess configurational entropy in your model, Okay, for the atomistic model, it's defined in the conventional way as an average over the atomistic configuration space weighted by the atomistic probability distribution. Now let's suppose that you just do nothing except for change the resolution of your model. So you're just changing the representation of your atomistic model to a coarse grain configuration space. And now PR here is the probability that the atomistic model samples an atomistic configuration mapping to the coarse grain configuration R. You can define an analogous configurational entropy over the coarse grain configuration space. And an idea that Scott introduced in one of his papers is to think about the entropy of this mapping. And in our recent paper, we showed that under certain conditions, you can relate this entropy of mapping to the difference between the excess configurational entropy of the atomistic model when represented at the atomistic level and when represented at the coarse grain level. This is totally independent of your coarse grain potential. Okay, this is just saying that you're changing the amount of entropy in your configuration space as a result of coarse graining, and this has nothing to do with throwing away degrees of freedom. And you can show that actually this corresponds to the average of something that's like the relative entropy evaluated for a given coarse grain configuration R. And moreover, you can show that this is less than zero. So that's kind of a very amusing result that tells you that you're changing something about your configurational entropy just by looking at the same system on a different length scale. And so I'll end there, and thank you very much for your time and attention and patience.
Please.
The Bjerregaard equation is defined for system with pair potentials, but you also want to compute effective potentials of bonds, angles, and so. Can you use it for this?
Yes. So the conventional Yvonne-Born-Green equation is generally considered to be an exact equation. If you go and look in your favorite StatMech book, perhaps Hansen and McDonald is a good example. You start off with a pair potential, and you go through the Liouville equation, you integrate out all the degrees of freedom, and it gives you an exact relationship between the pair potential and the resulting two and three body correlation function. That is the conventional interpretation of the Yvonne-Born-Green equation. This Yvonne-Born-Green equation works for any potential energy function that you can derive. It reduces to the old Yvonne-Born-Green equation when you use a pair potential, and moreover, it not only has the sense of being exact for a given pair potential, it has the sense that given a set of structural correlation functions generated by an arbitrarily complicated potential energy function, it determines the potentials of a given form that provide a variationally optimal approximation to the arbitrarily complex unknown potential. So this works for any potential energy function you can write down.
I have another question about extended ensembles. So you have introduced also consider different topologies. So how do you define the probabilities or weights of different topologies in the extended ensemble?
So that's a great question. And you could imagine doing it many different ways. If you care about some proteins more than others, you might weight them more. What we just did is we did the most stupid, simple, naive thing you could imagine and just weighted them uniformly. And I mentioned this work.
It's not uniformly, but how often that appears in PDB protein
data.
No,
we did not do it that way. So we have not yet applied this to the protein data bank, except for this toy model protein data bank that we constructed. So that's a good question. I mentioned this work only because people were talking about transferability, and this is a way that I think is a nice formal way to state the problem that people want to solve. And it allows you to formulate precisely what approximations people are introducing. And it allows you to precisely identify what is the correct thing people want. But there are many, I have not had time to go back. This is actually our first paper. I have not had time to go back and work on this more for a variety of reasons. But there are many aspects of this work that I find unsatisfactory at the moment. And one of them is the fact that this topology distribution is uniform, we haven't thought enough about it. But on the other hand, you expect that if there is a transferable potential, it should be robust with respect to this distribution.
In terms of using these information theoretic approaches in conjunction with force matching. What do you see as the prospects for, I guess, investigating whether your basis set is adequate without having to just do a simulation with the basis set? And whether there's, is there, do you see potential for predicting new basis functions that would help complete the set?
So that's a great question. Force matching very much depends, the accuracy, so there's a very, this is a problem that I keep on trying to tell people about, and I hope someone will solve it. I don't have the answer at the moment. But there's two closely related problems. One is you define a mapping for your system. Once you've defined a mapping, you have defined a potential mean force. It exists. You have no hope of calculating it. So you define an approximation to this potential mean force that specifies a particular basis set. The accuracy of your result then depends upon your basis set. And you can only improve the accuracy of your result by expanding your basis set. The question is, how would one want to expand that basis set? I don't know at the moment. I think at least as interesting is the converse question. In general, people only want to use a basis set of particular complexity. People want to simulate molecular mechanics type potentials. So that a priori sets some limit on your complexity of your basis set. The converse question is, if I'm only willing to deal with a certain basis set, how should I optimize my mapping to get the most mileage out of that basis set? And our work shows that improving the resolution of your model doesn't necessarily improve the accuracy of your approximation. And from my perspective, this work with the relative entropy is going to be particularly useful, and this is something I'm working with Scott on, in trying to inform how we can optimize the coarse grain mapping, how we can try to determine what is a good representation of a particular system.
With the new formulation of the force matching with that phi, can you now do coarse graining on discrete Ising-like systems?
That's an interesting question. I don't know. I would have to think about it. At the end of the day, either way, you have to figure out how does your information vary with respect to something like Cartesian coordinates. One way or another, you'd have to figure out, by discrete, you mean like on a lattice, you said, yeah. So one way or another, you have to figure out what is an effective force on your lattice. So in that sense, it doesn't really change that. I'm not sure. It's an interesting question. I don't know the answer to it. But thank, we could talk. If you have ideas, I'd love to hear them, maybe at the break.
Oh, tall order. You formulate force matching as a distance minimization problem in force field space. And that's very elegant, and you see kind of what you're doing, but there's, of course, no unique distance metric in force field space. And I wonder, whenever I see this equation, any arbitrary weighting function I put into this thing would, of course, also end up being a distance metric. Have you ever thought about what kind of games you can play with adding these kinds of functions?
You've asked me that question before.
So this is a repeated question.
Yes.
It's you a had very time good, in between.
It's a very good question. You asked, when you asked that initially, you would hope that we would be able to find some uber metric in which structure-based coarse graining and force-based coarse graining would turn out to be the same.
Yeah, you convinced me that wouldn't work.
And I think that the work with the relative entropy makes it manifestly clear that that's not possible. So I think that there is not some uber metric that would somehow make these two things equivalent. But it would be very nice if we could come up with a better metric. You're right. But the metric is one that comes, I mean, the metric is motivated by the definition of force matching. And this started with the idea of trying to understand why force matching works in some cases as well as it does. And so the reason is that for this particular metric, it does minimize the distance.
Okay. I can ask you a question.
I maybe have a couple of questions. One question is, when you are talking about this many proteins, like simulated protein data bank, and you apply force matching condition to this collection of different proteins, that sounds to me like an attempt to balance the force which acts on one protein, on parts of one protein, with the force that acts on the other protein. And that is not something that physically you need to do. That's one aspect of it. Another more general aspect of it is when you do the average for quench disorder system, you know that only self-averaging quantities should be averaged. If you average wrong quantity for the system with quench disorder, then you may obtain something that is not physically relevant. So is force the right quantity to be averaged over quench disorder?
So that's, okay, so there's two questions. The first is that I don't see that as a problem, because we're doing with the instantaneous force, it is a force balance relation, but we're doing the force balance relation on each protein. And we're using this force balance relation on each protein to try to determine a set of potentials for that protein. But then we make the approximation that we're going to use the same set of potentials on all the proteins. So I don't see that as being a problem. Does that answer your first question?
Well, continue, I don't know. Continue to the second half, because they are related, I think.
Okay, so the second question is this a good thing to do? I mean, is there self-averaging? And I'm not an expert on those types of problems. I'm not an expert in the statistical physics of quench disorder by any stretch of the imagination. It may be the case, I mean, I think that will be closely related to whether or not these potentials actually are transferable. I mean, you would expect that if this is in some sense self-averaging, that means that there is a potential that works on each different protein. That would be my intuition. And so in some sense, that is going to be some measure of how successful this is going to work. So I don't really have a great answer to your second question. I think it's closely related to how transferable these forces are going to be.
But isn't that the circular logic? If it is transferable, then it's self-averaging. But if it's self-averaging, then it's transferable.
Yes. So in some sense, it is. I agree with you. I think that the strength of this algorithm, from my perspective, as I mentioned, well, as I said, I find this work quite unsatisfactory at present. But I think that the strength of the work is that it gives us a framework for thinking about how to identify the correct potential that we want to have. And it gives us a framework for defining, for providing well-defined approximations, and for trying to improve upon those approximations.
Okay. Other questions?
I have a question. I mean, so you minimize the chi-squared of F by the appropriate force function. I mean, how big is chi-squared of F compared to average forces? I mean, is that some metric for whether it's a good fit if the instantaneous variations in the forces are small compared to some average force? I mean, does that tell you you've chosen the right set of coarse-grained variables?
So yes. Yeah, so you would think. I think that that's perfectly reasonable. I haven't looked at that, to be honest. I mean, I have thought about that. The reason I haven't looked at that is because when you go to this Yvonne-Born-Green equation, you can no longer directly evaluate that because you no longer know these. When you go to the structure-based approach, you don't have information about the fluctuating force, so you can't measure chi-squared. But yeah, I agree with you. I think that chi-squared would be a good measure for describing the fluctuations. And it's intriguing, because in this variational framework, chi-squared kind of plays the same role. So in this mapping entropy approach, you're dealing with fluctuations in the atomistic probability distribution about the probability for sampling the coarse grain configuration, right? So there's a given set of atomistic configurations that map to a given coarse grain configuration. This is measuring fluctuations in the atomistic probability distribution about the mean, averaged over the atomistic configurations that map to the given coarse grain configuration. And this actually enters into the theory in a framework that's very closely related to chi-squared and force matching. So I think it does tell you some information about whether or not you have a good representation of your system. But I have not extensively explored that idea.
Okay, at this stage we have to thank the speaker once again. And our next speaker is Christina Peter from Max Planck Institute in Mainz.